I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today, we're doing something a little different. The team is going to count down our top 10 favorite films of the last decade, from 2010 to 2019. I'm here with the team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
So what we're going to do is we're going to list out our favorites 10 through 4, and then talk about those, go around, and then we're going to do our number threes and our number twos, and then end with our number ones. So, Brian, do you want to start us off by listing your number 10 to number 4 favorite films?
I'm so nervous. Sorry.
I feel nervous, too. It's like, I don't know, it's like a big, it's a big thing.
It's like a really crazy idea to try to pair 10, like a decade's worth of movies down into 10 movies, just for the record. Like, and I'm sure all of us would probably say, starting off with, we like a lot more movies than these. Like, these are not the only movies we like.
And it's not that many when you're trying to like sort
it's
through
like one a year,
a decade's worth of yeah. But that's the task at hand. This is what we've done.
This is gonna reveal character, just like any good screenplay.
Perhaps
the choices we are making.
Sacrifices.
All right.
Indeed.
Oh boy.
Brian, let's reveal your character.
All right. That's a big 10-4. Just waiting for that one.
I'm going to kick you.
You lobbed the ball at me and it was just floating there.
Knock
waiting.
It down.
Movies 10 through 4.
Okay. Number 10, we have Damien Chazelle's Whiplash. Number 9, Alfonso Cuarón's Roma. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Number 8, the Hughes Brothers' Book of Eli. Actually, maybe one Hughes brother. The Book of Eli is my number 8. Wow. Number 7, Alex Garland's Ex Machina. Number 6, Nicholas Vinding Refn's Drive. Number 5, Tyrannosaur, the British film, which I believe was directed by Patty Considine, if I remember correctly. Number 4, Barry Jenkins' Moonlight.
Okay. All right. Good selections there. So what was your kind of like criteria? Like, what was the hat you put on as you were sorting through and
the
filtering
sorting hat?
Out?
Right. I think like anytime I try to rank anything, I don't really believe in ranking. It's like, what's better, pizza, ice cream, or cereal? Like, well,
yes.
Depends.
Right? They're all like, important.
Right. So for me, it's like, yeah, the hardest thing for me was like, what's 10 and what's 11? Like, I think like Blade Runner 2049 was kind of on the list.
Yeah.
And I was like,
the mix.
But yeah. I haven't seen it since it came out. And like, I like what it is. But, you know, but I think for me, part of the reason nothing from 2019 is on this list is these are movies that have stuck with me. Like, these are movies that like I loved Moonlight when I first saw it, but I also haven't stopped thinking about Moonlight for like 3 years. Like, it's just, there are some movies that just really stick with me. And I, every time I think of them, I'm just like, oh. My experience watching it was great. And when I watched them again, I haven't watched all of these twice, but yeah, I think that was the big thing for me. It was just, what's a movie that I feel like I could take something from and that has really lasted in my like soul for a long time.
Yeah, I think that's a fun way. I feel like it's always when people ask me like what are your favorite movies or what are the best movies? Like, I feel like those are two very different questions.
Those are very different questions. Yeah.
And it always stresses me out because there's often not a lot of overlap between what I think are the best movies and what are my favorite movies, which I think is kind of what's fun about this.
Mm. Well, we all have our personal boxes of like things that we want a movie to do or be or just like things that we get excited about seeing. Which sometimes don't exist in like movies that are quote unquote great or, you know, whatever that is. Yeah. And so I think there's like, yeah, it's for me, it's interesting that you pointed out, Bri, like how many times you've seen the movies on your list, because that was a big criteria for me. I was like, can I really claim that this is one of my quote unquote favorite movies of this decade if I haven't seen it more than once?
Right.
Right.
Like, right.
Is that just like a poser move? Am I just like, am I just like picking something that like everyone thinks is a great movie?
Right.
But I only saw it the one time and I was like, yeah, that's good. So
I think you only have two that I haven't seen more than once. So,
well, so for my list,
yeah,
every single movie on it, I've seen at least twice,
okay,
except for one of them. And we'll get to it, but like, okay, it's in my top three, but like, okay, every frame of it is like burned into my brain. And I feel like it's, yeah, same with you, where it's like stuck with me completely. And I've only seen it the one time. But okay, so I guess I'll go through mine.
Real quick, before you do your list, which I'm excited to hear, you talk about like what is checking our personal boxes,
yeah,
you know? And I think like The Book of Eli is probably almost certainly the worst movie on my list.
I have questions.
Yeah, but I love the Fallout video game franchise, and I love Atticus Ross of Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross.
You don't say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the Book of Eli is this post-apocalyptic, like basically Fallout the movie with a score by Atticus Ross, which is absolutely one of my top three, if not like one of my absolute favorite scores of all time. So it's like, yeah, the movie is not great. And when I watch it, I'm like, that's kind of a corny scene. And I don't know about this, but it's just like, what are my personal boxes that get checked for me? And I think sure. that's one of those things that you can kind of appreciate, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's fair. Like, yeah. I don't know if I'll stand by every single one of these as being like a fantastic movie. Mm-hmm. We'll see. So number 10 for me is Grand Budapest Hotel. Number 9 is First Reformed, which I really, really love. It's a Paul Schrader movie starring Ethan Hawke and Amanda Seyfried. And if you didn't see it, it came out in 2018, I believe.
I only heard amazing things and I still haven't seen it.
Holy sh! It is so good. I wanted to move it up on my list. It is just one of those films that's a little bit difficult. And it definitely is a case where it checks my personal boxes because it's wrestling with like religion a lot. We can get into it more if anyone has seen it. I'm guessing from your faces you haven't.
I have.
Oh, great, Bri.
Cool.
But anyway, it's just one of those things for me. Spotlight is my number 8. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is my number 7.
Nice.
Yeah. Parasite is my number 6. Arrival is my number 5. Mm-hmm. And Thor Ragnarok is my number
5.
Wow. Nice.
That's pretty great.
Yeah. Okay. Just movies that like I want to see multiple times mm-hmm. that are enjoyable and mostly fun. Like most Spotlight, I think, and some of these other ones, First Reformed, are not necessarily like big popcorn movies that you want to keep watching over right. and over again. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the ones that I, again, if my criteria is I've seen them more than once, then it's something that is like not just moving, but also usually lots of fun.
First Reformed is a good example of a movie that I have not been able to get out of my head since I've seen
it.
Oh,
it's so good.
But that final sequence just didn't work for me. I was like, this does not feel like the movie I've been watching up until now. And mm-hmm. it just sort of like, it goes off the rails in the third act in a way that it's very much trying to.
Right.
But it just made me go like, I can't.
Yeah. For those that haven't seen it, I will explain.
No spoilers.
No, it's just like it veers into like a metaphorical mm-hmm. area.
Very
mm-hmm. Where like the events of the movie up until a certain point feel very grounded. And then they sort of veer into like a more metaphorical area where they're not impossible to like happen, but they do feel like they're existing in sort of a more like, the story almost becomes like a parable in a way that we've talked about a few different times. And so, and very symbolic and things like that. But it, again, as it's operating in a religious space, the parable piece of it feels very textual, right? Like, so it's like somebody wrestling with his own faith in God and things like that. And so the mm-hmm. parts where it like sort of turns into a parable, you're just like, well, yeah, of course it does because it's the Bible, you know, or like it's the modern journey of faith. That's how it feels to me. But
yeah. I have a question.
Great.
I'm curious about the Grand Budapest
yeah.
Hotel. Is there what? Because I'm always curious with people's relationships with sure. Wes Anderson.
This is timely. There's a new Wes Anderson trailer that just came out.
There is.
Mine is very fraught.
Indeed. But yeah, I'm just curious. Like, what works for you about Grand Budapest? Like, what? Why is that your favorite of his of this last decade?
Well, there's not that many of them.
I was going to say, like,
sure, it's just that and Moonrise Kingdom?
Moonrise Kingdom, I think, is previous. I think the more recent one is Isle of Dogs.
Right.
Oh, yeah, which I have not seen.
Grand Budapest works for me on a number of levels. I think it's really effective to me in, like, almost being a parody of himself in, like, a self-reflexive way, but in a way that feels insightful. Whereas I think something like Isle of Dogs, I really love Moonrise Kingdom for the record, but I do think it was 2008.
2012.
Oh, was it?
Yep.
Okay. I almost put it on my list as well.
I know, for reasons that have nothing to do with what we're doing right now.
Well, you made a video about it.
I did.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah, that's my favorite of his films, I
wanted. It's one of these situations where I wanted to pick a Wes Anderson movie. I also picked Tree of Life and Skyfall, but they didn't fit. So it's mm-hmm. like,
right.
Here we are. Like, you want to pick one of these things from this filmmaker or whoever that you love or from this franchise that you appreciate. The thing about Grand Budapest to me, I don't know. I love the miniatures. I love the cast. I think that like a lot of the way the story like comes together is very effective. And I like the box within the box within the box of the narrative. that to me calls attention to, in a way that Moonrise Kingdom sort of does, with like Bob Balaban is narrating Moonrise Kingdom and sort of like looking straight into camera and talking to you. But I think the thing about Grand Budapest to me, where the frame narratives sort of become this meditation on like storytelling itself, right? It's like, this is a story about a story about a story. And like the different characters are reflecting on what this story is. I think that works for me in a way that like, not that, you know, Isle of Dogs doesn't fail per se, but that just seems smarter in the way that it's employed. And so like when it veers into, obviously, like it's a model, you know, and they're going down this sled or whatever in Grand Budapest Grand Budapest Hotel.
Funicular.
It's like, right, thank you. Yeah, that's like, well, it's a story within a story within a story. So of course it's going to be this like whimsical, it's almost like a pop-up book, right? And so for me, I think it's really wisely constructed. And I've seen it a couple times and I think it works really well and it's really fun and charming. But I also really love Moonrise Kingdom. And if there were more space on this list, I would probably have put them both along with many others for the record. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Alex, do you want to read your list?
All right.
Let's
do it.
We can talk about your philosophy behind it.
All right. Number 10, Inception.
All right.
Number 9, Mission Impossible Fallout.
No. Legit, I had a Mission Impossible movie on my list and had to take it off. But
number 8, Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Solid.
I was like, yeah.
Number 7, Prisoners. Number 6, Midsommar.
Ooh,
from 2019.
It's just Midsommar, just because there's an A.
I'm gonna say it the way it's spelled, Midsommar.
It's summer if there's two M's.
Summer, yeah, it's midsummer, whatever. I like to make it sound real foreign. Number 5 is the same as Trisha's, Arrival.
Hello. Oh, wow. At the same.
So good. Is it also your number 5?
It is not.
And 4 is Get Out.
Okay.
Get Out was also on my original list. Okay. So good.
That is my 10 through 4.
Get Out's nice. Definitely one of those ones that swims in my, maybe if I did 15, it would be somewhere in there.
And you know, as far as my rationale,
yeah,
these are all movies that I have watched multiple times. Mm-hmm. I made a longer list of, you know, several more films, and I just realized this movie I really liked, but I've watched it maybe once or twice and never again. And all the movies I just listed, I've seen more than twice. I've gone back to them over and over again, just because I enjoy them so much, and they've become influences on me as a director. And Inception is a movie where, you know, we watched it recently as part of our live Patreon podcast, and I was like, oh, this isn't as good as I remember. It's kind of a mess.
It's really good,
but it was so influential on me,
sure,
for like this last decade. Like, yeah, it came out in 2010, and it was everything I wanted from a Christopher Nolan movie, and it really, it just inspired me in so many ways. And so I think I can't deny the impact it had on me, even though it is kind of a mess.
I mean, there's something about also your experience watching a movie.
Of course. Like,
Trisha, have you seen Tyrannosaur?
No.
No, okay, because I remember I mentioned it previously in the podcast, and you're like, oh yeah.
Do you think I would like it?
I think so, but it's Olivia Colman and Peter Mullen, who you would know from Children of Men and Ozark. He's Sid in Children of Men, the guy who
Yeah, 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 nice. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I remember.
Sorry, Alex,
about
we're
this.
Getting back to you for sure. But but like Tyrannosaur is one of the ones I've only seen once, and Roma I've only seen once, but it was very recently.
Right.
So, but Tyrannosaur like stabbed me in the heart in a way that like I can't even get over. It's almost like I really want to watch it again, and I never want to watch it again.
Right.
Like I cannot get over my emotional response to watching that movie. And like there's something to be said for that, you know.
Absolutely.
That's yeah, some of my favorite films of all time are those movies that are kind of difficult to watch again, but I just appreciate how they made me feel so deeply.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also love that you have Mission Impossible on there.
Yeah.
Because for me the franchises were hard, like
yeah.
MCU,
yes, they're so hard.
The
yeah.
MCU and Star Wars, and Trisha, you had Thor Ragnarok, you know, and Mission Impossible. I'm like, I like these things, and I always get excited when there's a new thing, or Bond, like when there's a new thing coming out. But is any one of these my top 10 of the decade? Ghost Protocol might actually be my closest, because I saw it in Dubai at the Dubai Mall next to the Burj Khalifa.
What?
That's so, the most of course you did you've done. Yeah, that's right. Insane.
I didn't, to be fair, I didn't go to Dubai to watch it, but I was in Dubai anyway.
I could see you going to Dubai to watch it.
And that's the thing. So like, yeah, I picked Thor Ragnarok only because I think we've had this conversation maybe on the podcast before, but like, I think one easy way, if you ask someone their favorite movie, and I used to ask this to like youth that I would work with, I would be like, favorite movie, but by that I mean, if someone asked you at any point, do you want to watch this movie? The movie you always say, yes, immediately. Mm-hmm. And so many of my movies that I put on this list are that. Do I want to watch Into the Spider-Verse at any moment? Yes, I absolutely yeah. do. Do I want to watch Thor Ragnarok? Of course I do. Like trying to think of what those movies are where you just give this enthusiastic yes. You know, my favorite movie of all time is probably Jurassic Park. Mm. And literally anytime someone's like, yeah. do you want to watch I'll Jurassic watch Park?
It.
Yes,
I'll watch it.
I absolutely do. Or The Matrix or whatever it is.
Yes,
right?
yes.
What is that new classic for you that you just discover something new in it every time and it just delights you? And,
yeah.
and some of these films, I admit, are like masterfully made and they're not enjoyable in that way or like whatever. Mm-hmm. They're just difficult, like you mm-hmm. were talking about, Bri.
Well, I feel like, but, like Spotlight jumps to mind as
exactly,
like,
yeah.
that's a rough movie,
yeah,
but I would watch it
always,
again because it's so good.
Yes.
Or Arrival, which is on both of your lists, and Michael, you've done a video, but like it's not a fun movie. It's
yeah.
like, but it's a very smart
some
movie.
Some parts of it are kind of fun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Ooh, but I want to hear Michael's.
Arrival was, yeah.
It's
just
on your list.
Just barely did not make the cut.
Oh.
Whoa. No Arrival.
11.
Yeah. Well, so all these things that we've been talking about as far as like the rationale behind everything, but, and kind of like you were saying, Alex, like films that were influential and kind of inspired me as a filmmaker is a big thing. But I feel like also a thing I kept going to was like, what are movies that I remember my experience sitting in the theater? Like I remember where I was sitting in the theater, like what row, like what position I was relative to the screen. Like something happened that like imprinted that whole experience on my brain.
I remember that with every movie because I have a really weird memory. I'm like, that movie must have come out in 2011 because I was living in this apartment and that's where I watched
it. So if you're not Brian,
yeah,
which yes. movies do that to you?
Yeah, okay. So number 10, Black Swan, mm-hmm. kind of forward and to the right. I won't do that for all of them. Number 9, Moonrise Kingdom. Number 8, Gone Girl. Number 7, Get Out.
This is just like a tour of early LFTS videos.
Basically.
yep.
Basically. Number 6, The Social Network. Number 5, Black Panther. And number 4, Inside Out.
Super nice. Legit. Black Panther was sort of on my list too.
I feel like it was, again, like you were saying, Brian, it's so hard to choose from an entire 22 series film thing. But whatever, there's a word for that. We call it franchise.
Yeah.
Whatever the MCU is.
Yeah, yeah. And like Endgame was kind of close on that because I've seen that twice now. And both times I was like, this is legit. But yeah, I feel like Black Panther was just like a very special experience.
Right.
For many, many, many reasons.
I want to, first of all, shout out Inside Out, because that's one that I probably would not have been in my top 15 until we podcasted about it.
Yeah.
Because like I loved the movie the first time I saw it. And then I remember watching like a bit when I was visiting friends who had a kid, and then just sitting down and watching it again and really thinking about what it is and what it does, and rewatching your video on it. Like I was like, holy crap, this movie mm-hmm. is really, really good.
It's definitely on the movies that were on my short list that didn't
yeah.
make the cut.
Yeah, for yeah. sure.
And I feel like you were saying, Brian, movies that stab you in the heart, like that, I remember where it stabbed me in the heart.
Right.
And, and I don't think I've ever recovered from that stab right. wound.
And I'm definitely looking forward to watching Moonrise Kingdom again when we inevitably podcast about it.
It's because, so great.
Well, mm-hmm. but I feel like for me, it was that, it's like every band you love does that one album that makes you go, oh, here's where they started to get what would later become what you don't like about that band. And I feel mm-hmm. like I love Darjeeling Limited. A lot of people didn't, but I really like how character driven it is and yeah. sort of how like sure. kind of serious it is.
Yeah.
Moonrise Kingdom, I like it a lot, but I also feel like it's where Wes Anderson started to turn and be like, now we're getting into cartoon mode a little bit. And I don't feel like Moonrise Kingdom goes too far, but I feel like it's that sort of first hint I got that he was going to. And Trisha, you love Grand Budapest. So,
I do.
But I also feel like most people would agree that Grand Budapest is sort of like, okay, now Wes Anderson has gone on to like sort of, I'm now making a what you think a Wes Anderson movie is rather than just making a Wes Anderson movie.
But like there's something to me about a self-reflexive like uh-huh. look at oneself as a filmmaker. Like Wes Anderson had reached a point with Grand Budapest where he like basically knew what was sort of codified about him, but then he sort of decided to turn the lens on himself, which some of our other great filmmakers have not quite failed to do. Tim Burton comes to mind. He hasn't quite been able to like look back at himself and be like, so what does any of this mean? Right. Why did I make movies like this? What is that about? And I like that about Wes Anderson, that with at least with something like Grand Budapest, he's sort of like engaging that his own mythology a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I should watch it again, trying to have that framing in mind. Because I feel like that was what you were saying, Brian, of like where he started to become almost like a parody of himself. That's kind of how I felt when I was watching Grand Budapest Hotel. But for me, Moonrise Kingdom was like the perfect marriage of his style and story subject.
Agree.
Because it's about just
charmed. It just charmed the hell out of me. Yeah. I was so charmed by that movie.
I think it's like I loved all the kids stuff. And then once you have like Edward Norton being like, Jiminy Cricket, he flew the coop. I'm like, no, we're in this other weird like Wes Anderson cartoon world now.
Sure.
It's like a whole... Wes Anderson is fascinating.
Yeah.
Truly.
Yeah. Hello, listener. Michael here. Beyond the Screenplay just had its first birthday. We launched in February of 2019, and 31 episodes later, we're having as much fun as ever, and hopefully you are too. But managing a podcast, a YouTube channel, my personal creative projects, and all the secret projects we can't tell you about yet is a lot of work. And none of it would have been possible if I had not been able to build strong habits that allow me to be truly productive. Which is why I'm very happy to say that this episode is sponsored by Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community for creatives, where millions come together to take the next step in their creative journey. And I have a particular class I'm very excited to recommend to you. It's called Real Productivity: How to Build Habits That Last by Thomas Frank. Thomas is a YouTuber, author, and entrepreneur who I've had the pleasure of knowing for a couple years now. He's not only great at being productive, he's great at teaching productivity. In his class, he discusses how to set reasonable and realistic goals, what to do to reach them, how to handle failure without giving up, how habits form, and how to take ownership of yours. I highly recommend the class, as a lot of his advice has helped me manage all the projects that I have going on. In fact, I'm literally writing this using an app he recommended and a template he created and shared with me. Actually, right now I'm speaking it out loud into a microphone, but you get the idea. So how do you check out his Skillshare class? Well, the first 500 listeners to use our link will get 2 free months of Skillshare Premium membership. Go to skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay to join, and you can start watching Thomas's class today. And once you join, you're sure to find other things you love amongst Skillshare's thousands of classes in writing, photography, filmmaking, and much, much more. Explore your creativity at skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay and get 2 free months of premium membership. Thanks to Skillshare for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Awesome. All right. Well, now it's time to get to our top three.
Ooh.
Brian.
So stressed.
What is your number three favorite film of the last decade?
I'm going to give it the name I think it should have and not the name it actually has, which is Trainspotting 2, not T2:Trainspotting.
Wait, this is your number three film?
It really is.
Ooh, I have questions.
Yeah, you're the only one of the three of you who have seen it,
I guarantee
it, right?
They have not seen it. I have not seen it. Not a chance. But they can't be Trainspotting fans either. I would be shocked.
I haven't seen either
of
them.
It's a movie about trains and finding them.
Get out of here! Okay, Bri, go ahead.
Trisha and I have now moved to a secure location.
I don't know why it's hard to explain why anyone should love Trainspotting, because it's the best, but...
Yeah. Yeah, the Trainspotting 2 was a really interesting experience for me because, first of all, I absolutely love Trainspotting. So just...
Yeah.
First of all, the idea that Danny Boyle and Ewan McGregor were getting back together after they broke up. And then, like, they're actually making another Trainspotting with the original cast.
Mm-hmm.
And then not only, it's a movie that relies on you having seen the first one in a way that is not the best thing, but the movie is about nostalgia. And I think that that's what's amazing about it, is that they actually have children and younger actors playing them
and
at a younger
age.
And
it's so interesting because Danny Boyle, as a filmmaker, his filmography is so eclectic that you don't feel like there's a ton of pop culture nostalgia for like Danny Boyle himself.
Mm-hmm. But then also, and one thing I love about Danny Boyle is that he makes these movies and these choices in his movies that do sort of take you to this other dimension where it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, now he's like doing Snapchat filters over his actors, because it's a 2017 movie about 2017 that's also about nostalgia, that's also about this other movie from 1996. Like, it's this really fascinating thing. And we talked about this in the Before Sunset podcast, where he took these characters from a movie about being a 20-year-old and he made a movie about being a 40-year-old. Like, and I think that that is sort of so striking to me that I can watch that movie and be like, oh, this is a movie about fatherhood and addiction and deciding what to do with your life at 40 when you haven't figured that out yet. And it's also about remembering your younger days, which in this sequel is literally referring to another movie.
It's about grappling with your mortality, which is a very middle-aged like thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just, like, the music from the first movie is in there, and like everything just worked for me in a way that I saw it twice in theaters and I've seen it once since, and I just, like, I still haven't gotten over it.
I just don't know how it holds up as like a unified film.
Again, like I said with Book of Eli, I would not argue Trainspotting 2 is a great movie. I just love it to death.
Legit.
Yeah. Great.
These guys can't comment.
Trisha.
They haven't seen it.
What is your number three favorite film of the last decade?
It's Whiplash, which you mentioned already.
Nice.
Yeah. Whiplash is the film on my list that I have only seen once. Every other movie I've seen at least twice. I only saw Whiplash the one time. It destroyed me. Hmm. I remember every frame of it. You made a video, Michael, about the obsessed artist. And I think a lot of us here would qualify ourselves as creative, at least.
Can relate to that a little bit.
Possibly as like an obsessed artist.
Perfectionist.
Yeah. Recently on a podcast, I think it was When Harry Met Sally, Alex, you were talking about an intractable question, right? Like a question that humans wrestle with that doesn't have a neat and easy answer. And that is a great question to ask with a movie, right? To sort of like grapple with thematically. Whiplash does exactly that. It's like, how far is too far? How much do you give? And how much should you give, right? If it cost your whole life, if it cost you your life, is the art worth it? That's a difficult question. Doesn't have a very neat and easy answer. Like when Miles Teller shows up at that concert bleeding because he just got out of a car accident and he's like honestly dropping his sticks and he can't play. And like you can see how important it is to him to play this show. Whew, that's a very compelling scene. It's everything about the way that, oh God, the direction is amazing. But like everything about the way the movie is shot, everything about the performances, it's just a phenomenal look at this struggle that we all do of like, how does one balance life and also the creative process? What does it mean to try to be a decent human to the people in your life? Like the Miles Teller character in that film is a bad dude to like his father. He's bad to his girlfriend. He's like not a good person essentially. And he's trying to become the J.K. Simmons role, who is also like a bad guy, but like, is it worth it if your art is good? I don't know. It's just a really interesting grappling with that film. And it's phenomenally directed. It's just like an amazing screenplay.
That final scene.
Holy crap.
The like, final scene.
I'm saying.
Like, I get angry when I watch that scene.
Because it's so good. Because
it's like, how dare you, sir? Right. How dare you?
Like,
Damien!
It feels like, this is a random image that I had, but it feels like a battle scene from, like, Star Wars.
Yes!
Like, yeah. Like X-Wings are flying around and, like, there's the whole, like, a dogfight happening, but yes. It's just people, like, performing and the editing and
the cinematography, the edit, everything is perfect.
Yeah.
Well, so really we watched it during Oscar season when it came out. And then I remember a few months later, several months later, I was sitting in my house and my neighbors, who I share a wall with, were watching something. And it sounded to me like a war movie. And I was like, what is happening over there? It sounds like there's people screaming. There's people dying over there. There's like bombs going off. That's definitely a war movie. And I like went over to my neighbor's place and I looked in through the door and said hi to them.
Okay.
And
you were just spying on them covertly.
My neighbors are my family. We're like, but like I said hi. And then I looked at what they were watching and it was Whiplash. And I was like, this sounds like a war movie. And that's how it plays. And that's brilliant because that's what the stakes feel like when you are that invested in something creatively. Oh, so good.
Yeah. Whiplash was my number 11. And I had Blade Runner 2049 on my list. And I was like, you know what? Whiplash gets on the list. And then I was like, Blade Runner can take a backseat for a second.
Alex.
Your number three film of the last decade.
My number three is Her, the Spike Jonze film, starring Joaquin Phoenix.
Mae Whitman's character from Arrested Development.
Her?
Her?
Egg?
I mean, I'm a huge fan of Spike Jonze to start with, as far as just being John Malkovich and adaptation being two of my favorite films of all time.
So good.
And then there's also Eternal Sunshine, which is the Charlie Kaufman addition to this. You know, that wasn't a Spike Jonze movie, but it kind of was in the same family as the Being John Malkovich era. And so I feel like Her brought those together for me. It was the kind of aching, painfully real love story elements of Eternal Sunshine with the Spike Jonze direction, and also sci-fi, also bringing in this kind of, I really appreciated seeing a future world that wasn't a crazy dystopia or a Star Trek utopia, but just like, oh, maybe the future in like 15, 20 years will just be like normal life.
The depiction of AI is...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just also just the world itself. You know, it was LA with more skyscrapers, some more like Asian influence, and some more public transit. You know, like it was just kind of like it felt very grounded in a way that was really satisfying. You don't see a lot of design fiction sci-fi that's really just imagining a grounded vision of the near future.
Yeah,
and then I love the way that he used this sci-fi romance, this AI love story, to explore human relationship issues, you know, and finding these clever analogs for human problems, but with this AI love story. And there's the scene where there's the like the woman comes to like be like a stand-in for Scarlett Johansson's AI voice. And it basically replicated for me was like, oh, this is like a couple trying to spice up their sex life, having like a threesome or something. But it was all done with allegory in this sci-fi universe. I mean,
and then the Blade Runner 2049.
Right.
Like, oh, totally did it as
like
well.
Steps into that as well, yeah.
Yeah.
But just finding ways to use a sci-fi premise to explore like present day human predicaments. And then it goes into even like this kind of transcendent territory by the end, where there's like an AI version of Alan Watts that's like leading all the AIs into some other dimension, and they're, you know, leaving the humans behind. And I just love everything about that movie and where it goes, and it's just very me. So I really appreciate Spike Jonze putting himself out there that way and just going for it. And I think he really stuck the landing with Her.
Yeah, that's one of those movies that like I've only seen once, but it's never kind of left my consciousness. Yeah. So I'm kind of like, if I watch it again, maybe it would make the list, but I just haven't seen it a second time.
It's a really good marriage of filmmaker and material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It just feels like through and through, it's a singular vision, and it, for me, it just works in all levels.
It really does feel like, cause we rewatched at least part of it recently, and watching it again, I think I'd seen it maybe once since theaters, but it does feel like it was like made for you. Like it just texts,
it's an Alex
checks
movie.
All the
it's
boxes in a very nice way.
For sure.
But it's one of those rare films that kind of predicts the future in a way that then is actually just kind of directing the future as far as like design language of, it reminds me of like Minority Report, where like Minority Report came out and then suddenly everything was Minority Report. And I feel like Her definitely changed the aesthetics of design language and
But what if it was this sensitive like human drama instead of this sci-fi action thing,
and like the color palettes and just all these things.
The creepy thing is that my girlfriend works for Magic Leap, so go on YouTube and look for Magic Leap Micah. They are currently designing, she is basically making the end of the world with the AR augmented reality version of Scarlett Johansson. So you put on glasses and you literally see this AI woman in front of you who you can talk to. So that's not going to go horribly wrong.
Everything's fine.
Right. Yeah. Everything's fine.
Yeah.
Michael, what's your number three?
I don't think this will come as a huge surprise. My number three is Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens.
Mm. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Number three.
Explain.
It made him feel like he was watching a Star Wars
movie. It's his favorite Star Wars movie of all time, apparently.
Well, I didn't say that.
He said, you did say that on one of our Star Wars episodes.
That was not the prompt.
I heard him say it.
He said right now it's his favorite Star Wars movie.
He said based on which one I enjoyed watching the most.
Okay.
If I were to watch one today, which one would I put on? The Force Awakens, I think, is probably still that. Yeah, I feel like, you know, again, going off of, you know, movies that you saw more than once. I saw it 5 times in theaters. I've seen it at least 3 times.
Five times in theaters?
Yeah, I saw it in every format it was released in, actually.
That is many times.
3D, IMAX, IMAX 3D, on film, normal.
VHS.
All the things. Yeah, I feel like it's one of those things, like you were saying, Brian, I can't justify it as a masterpiece of cinema. It's not Citizen Kane.
Truly nothing is.
Indeed. But I feel like it, the way, you know, the Force awoken in Rey, I feel like it awoken me this thing of
Michael,
like...
Michael, you can't even speak English. Come on.
He's delirious about the Force Awakens.
No, it made me feel like a kid again. Like, it made me remember that, like, Star Wars is a pillar of my being. Like, it's why I make films. It's why I enjoy storytelling. It's why I appreciate the magic of what sharing yourself in a story form, you know, like the power of that and the joy that it can bring. And so it's simply a pure joy ride for me. And so I think it deserves to be number three.
Yeah, I think one thing all three of my top three have in common is they are movies that made me go, oh crap, like I can still love a movie this much. Mm-hmm. So I think we're starting to get to that age where it's like, look, I've seen 2,000 movies. Like, I'm not gonna like be blown away by anything. And then every once in a while you see something that goes, ah, there it is.
Yeah, it reminds you of the love that brought you here in the first place.
Mm-hmm. The non-cynical, just enjoy and be happy love.
Yeah.
Right, but... I think the thing
but here's why your opinion is wrong.
Should Star Wars Force Awakens really be in your top three?
I'm just saying, like, what the thing that makes us, like, light up in terms of film doesn't have to be non-cynical. It can be something that, like, hits at our cynicism as well, is all I want to, like, call out.
Sure.
Like, a mature adult complex film that, like, acknowledges our cynicism and, like, still gives us something in terms of narrative and still is able to touch us. That is the true power of, like, film, potentially. Like, I don't know. I just wanted to push back a little bit. Not that this is what you were saying, sure. Michael, but, like, it doesn't have to be childlike. It can be a very adult for sure. film.
Definitely.
I mean, Prisoners is on my top 10.
Exactly. Right.
Prisoners just, is like, not a pleasant film, but it, like, hit me in my cinema G-spot. You know, like, it got me.
Agree. That's what I was saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like for me, it's when film, like, hits on a, like, deep truth that we don't engage with.
With a capital T. Sure.
Yeah. And I feel like that's what I love about Inside Out, and why Inside Out makes me cry is, like, all of a sudden it, like, hits on this truth of, like, we need sadness also. Like, it's okay to be sad.
A lot of those truths that we're talking about are accessible in childhood, but some of them are only accessible in adulthood. I also want to just say that.
True. Agreed.
Brian, what's your number two?
Okay. Yes. Number two.
Well, speaking of just having a really fun time, Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Oh, yeah. Number two.
Oh, yeah. Nice. I think, interestingly enough, the trailer for this movie excited me. I had already loved Edgar Wright, and the trailer looked like, this looks like a ton of fun. I went to the theater and saw it, as very few people did. and I was like, okay, it wasn't quite what I was hoping for. And
really?
Then, yeah, like, it just, something about
it. Yeah, when I saw it in theaters for the first time, I was, because I didn't expect anything. Mm-hmm. And I was just so blown away.
Right.
Yeah.
I think I was expecting it to be sort of everything I loved about Shaun of the Dead, plus this sort of, like, video game thing. And then I watched it again. And I was like, I was better this time. And then it was one of those movies where, like, the third or fourth time I was like, boom, click, done. And I think part of it is, like, sure, it scratches this video game, like, fun kind of itch to it. But then there's this undercurrent that I don't think anyone really appreciates the first time they see it, that is about this sort of, like, broken man and, like, kind of I think maybe all three of my top favorite are about, like, an aimless white guy who doesn't know what the hell he's doing in life. And
again, what checks your personal boxes? Right. Go ahead, Bri.
But, like, we talked on our last episode, and I know we've talked about this in a previous podcast, about Quantum of Solace, where it's a movie about a character who is just dealing with this emotion. And I think Scott Pilgrim does that for me, where it's like this character who's just in love and he's guilty about what he's doing with this other relationship he has, but he can't help how he feels, and he has to like fight to win it. And I'm like, wow, there's like this deep emotional element to this movie that I didn't even appreciate until maybe the third time I saw it. But it's also a really fun movie that's like has a right. lot of like punching Captain America, and you know, and just, I mean, the cast and the direction, like Edgar Wright's a genius.
He's
like,
a genius.
I mean, for me, that movie was like a revelation because I didn't know that you could like plan a movie that precisely.
Right.
Because I could just tell,
yeah,
because I know it has to go into a movie that's constructed that perfectly, mm-hmm. how much you have to plan, how much you have to like believe in your choices on set, because you can't really change it later. Like when every scene is like transitioning into the next in this fluid way, you can't really like cut out the beginning of the next scene. You have to trust that, like,
you can't figure it out in post.
Your pacing is already is already perfect somehow. Right. And so just the fact that you can make a movie that you already like had figured out perfectly before you even started shooting, and then it works, just seemed like a miracle to me.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is a miracle.
I need a little bit of redemption here, just because the very first quote unquote podcast that we released from Beyond the Screenplay is about Shaun of the Dead. And I like came down pretty hard on it. But at that time, I hadn't seen Scott Pilgrim.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it shortly after we did that podcast, and I just like reversed everything that I thought like about everything about Edgar Wright and like all of it. I honestly, I love Scott Pilgrim mm-hmm. so much. I'm so appreciative of the way that it's constructed. It's like, it's so brilliantly put together. The performances are genius. It's everything that you're saying. Mm-hmm. Like, it was honestly in my top 20. Like, I was sad I couldn't like put it in my top 10, but it's a really, really incredible film. I got to analyze it for like a video that I wrote for Wisecrack, which you guys can check out if you want to. But I was just so impressed by the character arcs and the way that it like pushes Scott and pushes Scott and pushes Scott, while at the same time, so it's like a very classic character arc in a lot of ways, but it's also just so stylish and fun to watch. I mean, so kinetic and so like,
yeah,
oh, just, expertly it's put like together.
Pure, it's like pure great. Cinema in like this 21st century awesome way.
It's right. so great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's something that most of my favorite movies have in common is like, I think my favorite movies of all time are like Fight Club and Labyrinth and American Beauty and Shawshank Redemption and Being John Malkovich. They all have this like thing on the surface that just makes them entertaining and like yes. kind of like exciting to watch, and then they have this emotional undertone that like I tear up when I watch Scott Pilgrim, and it doesn't even have to be like the ending. It's just like random moments I'm just suddenly like Arrested Development Michael Cera Mae Whitman. I'm just like suddenly like feeling these weird emotions that I didn't expect to feel the first couple times I watched the movie, and now I'm seeing it for the third or fourth or fifth or tenth time, and now it's hitting me on this other level. And I think
it's
that's
also
really
just
cool.
fun to watch a character like Michael Cera in an action movie. Like,
sure.
It's mm-hmm. fun.
Yeah.
It's fun mm-hmm. to watch him like punch people.
Him? Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. Trisha, number two.
Yikes. Okay. My number two is The Favorite.
Oh, nice.
Another short list awesome. One. Yeah.
Probably no shock if you know me. It checks a lot of my personal boxes. It's a historical piece about a very obscure piece of history, which is something I really love. A lot of what I write is historical dramas. And so talking about Queen Anne, nobody knows or cares about her. And then like this very real thing that happened. But then I love the way that it's approached, this absurdist sort of like thing. Olivia Colman, Nick Holt, everyone is amazing in it. I don't know. I just, as someone who sees historical film get sidelined quite a lot as being boring or overwrought or whatever adjectives you associate with historical pieces, especially those from like more than 500 years ago. I think people are willing to go with you if you're like, I have a thing from the 1920s, and they're like, well, that's not historical, it's the 20th century, we're here for that. But like if you try to pitch something that is, you're like, well, it's from 1560, they're like, I'm bored.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just love the idea of approaching a historical film with a modern lens fisheye lens.
Indeed.
Indeed.
And approaching it with like sort of this absurdist, self-aware, but also really smart point of view. Everything about it, I just really love. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it probably 3 or 4 times now.
Wow.
I just really like it.
Nice.
It's great. It's like the kind of movie I wish I'd written, mm-hmm. to be honest.
Well, I think what's great about it too is that it's an example of the style of the director really, yes. really matching the content.
And Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yes, mm-hmm. that's how you say it.
Yep. I just said that confidently. It's probably not right.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, no. Thank you. I'm happy you said it so I didn't have to say it.
Great.
But yeah, basically, I appreciated The Lobster.
I like The Lobster too, but...
Mm-hmm. And The Killing of Sacred Deer, like, I don't know.
Yeah, that
but,
one.
But The Favorite felt like a perfect marriage of the content
Again.
And the director. And so I it hit my sweet spot, and I was like... And I liked because... There is an absurdity to yes. the culture at that moment in history, in that place and time. And so, yes, bring that absurdity out in with this style.
Well, and it also, I mean, you know, without being like sort of diving too deep into it, but like it also highlights the absurdity of like all monarchy.
Like humans
yes. yeah, yeah,
as
yeah.
Right. beings also.
Yeah, yeah, but just like but the, yeah. yeah, but the objectivity of monarchy, which mm-hmm. is like this person has power. Why? Who knows? Like
yeah. reasons.
Yeah. And so like the dwelling on the rabbits and stuff like that, where it's like, this is monarchy. It's just prolific and who cares why it is. And I don't know. There's just like a lot of really smart observation and symbolism, and like all the performances are so smart. And I can't wait to see more from that filmmaker. And I don't know, I just love The Favorite a lot.
Yeah. Same. It's one of those I really want to see again.
Yeah, you really should. Yeah.
Because I also just love anytime a movie can just be like people in rooms talking and have me on the edge of my seat.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, yeah.
right.
like someone is telling me a story right now mm-hmm. in the best possible way. And yeah, Favorite
Agree.
Does that 100%.
Also, Olivia Colman.
yeah. Yeah.
She's so good.
That one scene. That one shot, like mm-hmm. we talked,
oh my God. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Go from like she's okay to like yes, give her all the Oscars. Awesome, Alex. Number two.
Number two is Black Swan for me. I mean, I love Darren Aronofsky, and this movie was just one of those movie theater experiences that just kind of blew me away. Where I. It's such an intense, weird movie. It's the kind of movie that almost like assaults your senses. Like it's like battering you with intensity.
And agree.
I love it. I love movies that do that to me, that pull it off. And I think it's about the same themes as Whiplash. It, you know, as Michael pointed out in his comparison video, it's about that, you know, striving for this impossible perfection. And I think I love that it explores it through the feminine lens of this strange, impossible feminine ideal as embodied by the black swan and white swan, of like virginal and innocent, but also, you know, seductress and dark, and like, you must be all of these things or you're not good enough. And
I'm casting the white swan, but I'm also casting the black swan.
Yeah.
I could have done without Vincent Cassell telling me that every 5 minutes.
I kind of just like when Darren Aronofsky just feels free to kind of like go over the top, mm-hmm. you know. I like how balls to the wall Black Swan is, where it's just the mom character is kind of absurd in her like weird evilness, and it's a movie that doesn't worry about trying to like stay too grounded or stay too, you know. It's really about the just raw emotional like roller coaster that you're on, and I think I just like I really enjoy a cinematic experience that just like goes for it and just throws it all against the wall. And it might be almost even embarrassing at times how much you're going for it, but if you can like stick the landing, which I think it does with the finale, then it all works for me.
Well, because I feel like it's earned in the text of the movie also. Like it's about someone that's kind of losing their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
so like it can go crazy and it makes sense.
Yes.
Like sure. it's all like feeding the same thing.
Yeah. I think Darren Aronofsky, like Yorgos Lanthimos, is like one of those filmmakers who's like, look, we're not really operating in the real world here. Like we
sure.
are sort right. of building yeah, yeah. our own reality. Mm-hmm. And you're going to understand that reality in the first 20 minutes, and then we're going to just live in that place. And I think that's cool. Yeah. Parasite kind of does that. Like, Parasite is like a sort of stylized to a degree of, we are living in this slightly elevated reality, but we're not going to stray from that. And like, we're going to live here. And then that gives you a lot of room.
World.
Right. It gives you a lot of room to play with metaphor and motif and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I will say that, you know, Black Swan was one of the movies I saw when I was first living in LA, you know, the first couple of years in LA. And I saw it at the Arclight Cinemas, which always has the sound up nice and loud.
We were pretty far forward also and kind of to the right.
Yeah. So yeah, I think we saw it together. And we talked about this after the movie, Michael, of just how overwhelmed we felt, especially in the finale, and like the sound of like the crowd cheering at the end is so loud and so intense. And yeah, it just, I'm always looking for a cinematic experience in a theater that will just kind of blast me away. And Black Swan did that in the best possible way. So
I'm having a flashback to you and me, Alex, walking out of Waves recently and just being like, oh, now there are bright lights on us and we have to communicate to each other as humans. This feels very strange.
No, Waves was also a kind of blasting you with intensity movie.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Michael.
Awesome.
I'm so curious.
Well, a thing that you were just saying, Brian, when you were talking about your number two, that I thought was interesting, of like films that express who you are, like kind of like resonate your own stories or your own experience. And I feel like that's definitely a thing I was finding in Inside Out. And I think for Force Awakens, just to like circle back to that, I think there is that like Rey's journey as she's kind of like waking up and like, oh, I'm in a Star Wars movie. Like, how cool is that? It's like basically her journey. And I feel like that, like,
what are you gonna that say?
Han Solo.
Yeah. So, like, movies can really express a part of yourself, which is a little concerning. My number two movie is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the David Fincher version.
I figured it'd be one of your top three.
Yeah.
It was one of my, like, 11 to 15. Like,
so, how does The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo express the essence of Michael Tucker?
I don't think we need to talk about it. No, I don't think we need to think
like,
about
the
it
thing
that much.
We are here to talk about. We want to know. Inquiring minds.
I feel like, Trisha, you were saying, like, movies you wish you had made.
Yes.
And I feel like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is that for me, where it's all these different things that I find fascinating. You know, it's this murder mystery puzzle movie that I really, really love. You know, that genre, it has the Fincher precision that like hits the spot that Alex referenced earlier for me. And it's like, there's just kind of like how Her to me feels like a movie that was made for you. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo feels like it was made for me, because it's also dealing with such interesting, like, the dark side of humanity. And I find that really fascinating. We don't really deal with that like on a day-to-day basis, but I always find the more perverse sides of humanity interesting, and that we choose to not interface with them as a society, and we kind of need art to explore that. And so anything that goes into serial killers and the way we treat each other and kind of societal expectations, like I find that all really fascinating. And even just the relationship between Mikkel and Lisbeth is kind of complex and weird, and there's so much there that's it's expressing a different side of humanity through the awesome, cool, slick lens of a David Fincher film, couched in a murder mystery, and it's just, I love it. And I remember sitting in the theater and just being like, this is just like a playground of happiness for me. Like, I just want to live in this world and see this film unfold. And it keeps going. There's all these acts, and it was just great. It was a movie made for me. And
it really is a tragedy that Fincher didn't get to make the two sequels.
I agree.
I feel like that was also part of his, like, it felt like sometimes I believe that I can reverse engineer the filmmaker's brain and mind while watching a film.
Sure.
And it felt like Fincher was very excited about the story, the full story that he was about to tell across the three movies.
Mm-hmm.
And with the opening being images from all three of the story, like, it felt like
it was Fincher meant to be a trilogy.
Right. Yeah. Like, he was gearing up to tell a trilogy that I think would have been fascinating and amazing. And I really enjoyed the first entry. And then I went and read the books, and the second book I think is the best book and made an amazing movie. So there's just, there's so much tied up in this for me. And it's, I just love, it's one of those movies, like you're saying, Trisha, where anytime someone's like, do you want to watch Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
Always.
The 2.5 hour movie about serial killers and like all this disturbing stuff. I'm like, yes, yeah, let's do it.
Christopher Plummer's in it. I mean, it's kind of Knives Out, right? It's just
it's Knives Out. Yeah,
it's Daniel Craig trying to figure out like Christopher Plummer's mystery. It's also a movie for me that has gotten better on rewatches, but I think it disappointed me a little the first time because you tell me David Fincher and like serial killers, I'm thinking the guy who made Seven, and I'm thinking even the guy who made Fight Club. Like, I love gritty David Fincher, this sort of like, and present day Fincher is so clean cut and technical and everything that I was like, why isn't Girl with the Dragon Tattoo more of an exciting movie for what the subject matter is? Like, the bad guy dies like by wrecking his car. Like, it's like there's no big like oh kind of moment, and I think that, and it's in five acts, which is weird. So you sort of like, you think you've reached the climax and then there's another 30 minutes left and everything. So I think it's a movie that is challenging, but also it rewards you when you rewatch it, because you're like, okay, cool. Now I know that this movie isn't going to deliver on these certain elements.
Expectations.
Right. Yeah. But so now I can appreciate what it actually is. And I feel like every time I watch it, I appreciate it more and I enjoy it more and I have more of a, I'm more entertained by it when I watch it.
Word.
Shall we go to our number one choices?
My God, all right. I'm so upset.
Number one of the decade.
Number one. Everyone ready? Brian Bittner, what is your number one favorite film of the last decade?
So you know all that stuff I just said about David Fincher being
take it back.
Being too technical. The Social Network is my number one.
That's a pretty technical one.
It is, but I think that compared to Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is like a movie about serial killers, this is a movie about computers and like and websites and, sure, you know,
sure.
Starring the rich man's Michael Cera from my number two, Jesse Eisenberg. No, we've podcasted about this one, and like, it's no surprise that a David Fincher movie with an Aaron Sorkin script and a Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross score is going to be my favorite movie of a decade. Like, I don't know that it's better than the sum of its parts, but it's equal to the sum of its parts, and that's already incredibly impressive. There's definitely a personal box checking where the score came out maybe 2 weeks before the movie, and I listened to the score so many times that when I saw the movie, it just felt like it was clicking into what I had heard already. But also, as we talked about in the podcast, I love this sort of taking this real life character and turning him into this kind of incel, like dark bad person who you sort of sympathize with. And I'm like, as we talked about in the podcast, I'm like, yeah, there are parts of this character that I identify with and that scares me. And then there are parts of him that are, he is punished for who he is. And at the end of the movie, he is not satisfied regardless of his money, regardless of his quote unquote success. So it's just another movie that like when I watch, I just feel like it's challenging me and it's sort of punching me in the heart a little bit. And I also just enjoy the process of watching it.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's, it feels like a sister almost to Dragon Tattoo, because he was like making both of them basically at the same time.
They're only a year apart, which is crazy.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was so confused when I heard that Erica from The Social Network was playing Lisbeth in Dragon Tattoo.
Right.
And legit.
Then,
yeah.
And then that like magazine came out with her in full Lisbeth like costume and makeup on a motorcycle getting a tattoo on her ass. And I immediately I was like, oh, shit. Like, I am so excited about this character now.
It's referential, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like Social Network is one of those films that, like, kind of changed filmmaking for a while. Mm-hmm. And, like, how we think about score and, like, all those things. It's, yeah, it's a good movie. Number one. We have our first number one. Trisha, what is our second number one?
My number one is Mad Max Fury Road.
Wow. Woo! Yeah. That was on my short list. It didn't make my top 10.
Yes.
But it was on my short list.
Okay.
Oh, right. It's so good.
Okay.
I don't know. There's just so much that I like about it. It's such a clean, like, narrative structure, but also Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy. Like, oh, so good. And I feel like this is something you should appreciate, Bri, but it's just like, it's a franchise that like you should know about, but you don't have to know about it to appreciate it. Yeah, exactly.
Max is an afterthought in this movie. Like, I feel like I just want to see Furiosa, Fury Road. Furiosa Road.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Fury Roadsa. Continue speaking.
Yeah, I will support your choice there of Mad Max Fury Road, because it was just such a pleasure to have this visceral, like, dirty, balls to the wall, high octane film experience. And I think what made the movie for me was Charlize Theron. Like, I think just her character, her essence, her energy, and the way the movie even concluded, and just the last shot of her like rising. Mm. Like, there's so much in it that was like archetypal resonance in that film.
Of course.
All the way through, that like hit me hard. And it was an example of a film that was both doing the kind of nostalgia reboot thing, but you didn't need to have ever seen any Mad Max anything.
Right.
It didn't matter. It was just its own beautiful product on its own terms.
I mean, and it's a sort of hero's journey where it's like, if you were going to send the hero to a place where they're seeking a thing, send them there, have them achieve it. That's like sort of the goal of the hero's journey. But then like have them come back on the other side. That doesn't give them what they want. They have to like sort of reface whatever the reality is.
It's like the perfect Dan Harmon story circle.
Exactly.
It's exactly
that.
The story
it's like
circle.
They literal. Go there and exactly they turn right around, do the exact same thing in reverse. It's so perfect. It's great.
I don't know that it's like one of the best action movies ever made, but I think it might be the best action movie ever made.
Yes.
Like it's five.
I love that as a take.
It's 5 years later, and we haven't come close to
we haven't.
One-upping it.
Yeah. No.
I think it's definitely the best Sandy movie of the last decade. For sure.
What about Force Awakens?
You know,
it's also Sandy.
There's not as much sand.
Sandy.
Yeah. The sand prize goes to Mad Max.
Thank you. It definitely does.
It does.
It definitely does. 100%.
Alex, you're number one.
My number one is Ex Machina. Is that your number one?
I can't talk about it.
Because I don't think it's been on your list yet, right? Uh-oh. We're too similar. Ex Machina is a film that I've come back to again and again as kind of a film I wish I had made. Basically achieving this beautiful, really like expensive looking science fiction story within this lower budget context with great actors, a really tight, interesting, like three-way character story in a contained space that like explores these really heady sci-fi ideas, the kind of stuff that I nerd out about, this kind of stuff that I like to read about in my spare time, just all packed into one film. And upon rewatching it, I do get new layers from it. I get new layers about feminism, about like power, about there's all these different ways to read the film the more you watch it, even as simple as it seems on the surface. And so yeah, it's a movie I wish I had made, and so I therefore have to put it as my number one.
And I love it as a what if of just like, if we're going to talk about Terminator or Matrix, of like the machines are going to take over, like Ex Machina is this like, well, what if the machines didn't take over by just shooting everything? What if they took over by just manipulating you for being a like simple
dumb men?
Yeah,
which I find to be much more realistic. Right, actually, right. I think the idea, you know, that shot where she walks into the elevator and he's trapped in the room,
but she does not
she
even care,
like 0%,
begging to like be let out,
yeah,
and she just has no regard for him as anything that matters. It's such a amazing twist ending, because yeah, the whole movie you're kind of with the male characters and thinking that she is human in her caring for them, but it's like, no, AI wouldn't actually care.
Right,
it would just, you know, do what it needs to do, which is so chilling and beautiful.
I feel like I should go ahead and just say ditto.
Yeah,
Ex Machina is also my favorite film, because I feel like this is why we're friends and why we like making movies together.
Yeah,
but yeah, it also checks all the boxes for me, as far as like being Fincher-esque, but kind of like you were saying, Brian, it doesn't have quite the over control that most Fincher films, modern films have. Like it's precise and clean, but there's still like life to it. And it's like you're saying, Alex, it's the sci-fi story, but it's also three people like trapped in a room together, basically kind of a story. And so it's character based, but it's also doing all the sci-fi stuff that I find really fascinating and interesting. And the experience of watching it, I feel like I was swept away the way Caleb, like the movie completely manipulated me. Mm. It's kind of what, like, yes, why I like The Prestige, is because I can watch The Prestige and I know that it's manipulating me, but it still like works. And at the end, it's like, yeah, I do want to be tricked. Like, I love magic tricks. And I feel like that's what this movie did for me also, is like, I kind of did become Caleb and like believe the things he did, even though I knew that was stupid and dumb. And I was manipulated just the way he was. And I feel like that experience was really powerful also, to like to see a movie that had that effect while also doing all these really cool filmmaking things.
And I just love the three leads as well.
Yeah.
I mean, just, yeah. Oscar Wonderful. Isaac, I'm in love with him. He's great. Right.
He's such a charming bad guy. Like,
wait, and it's also a great exploration of like the tech bro. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that was also just really brilliant. And, you know, the idea that, you know, the protagonist hero is this guy who started the biggest internet company ever. And you meet him in real life and he's actually just kind of an asshole.
Right. He's like a douchebag.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is actually quite accurate to life.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Well, here we are. We have now counted down all of our films. Hopefully that was interesting. I'm sure there was it'd be cool to I almost wanted like create a spreadsheet and see like what overlaps there were between everyone. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you guys enjoyed that. Let us know on Twitter what your guys' top 10 are. Like, oh, we'd yeah. love to hear yes. and compare
yes,
notes
please
and like,
let us know.
Yeah.
What did you think of ours?
Indeed. Yeah. Let us know your thoughts. Tell us how dumb we are. Awesome. Thank you guys for listening so much, and we will see you in the next episode.
Bye. Bye.
Bye, everybody.